This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. I want to welcome everyone who is listening this week, and in particular, some new listeners. I suspect we might have a few new people who might be tuning in here this week. We are celebrating something kind of interesting. First of all, of course, this is National Magic Week. We're kind of in the middle of this right now. It started on October 25th, and it goes through the 31st. It's a time in which it supposedly was started back by Harry Houdini, by the Society of American Magicians, in which that it is encouraged for magicians to go to hospitals and to particularly to children's wards and to perform some magic and to make their day a little bit more joyful. And so this is, again, a good way to promote yourself. And we've talked about this last week, mentioned it in the pod letter. If you subscribe to that, you knew a little bit about that then as well. But you can go to the SAM website and learn a little bit more about that. But I'm just saying that's kind of what was going on this week. But also a new copy or issue of the Magic Unity and Might, that's the MUM magazine, or actually the journal for the Society of American Magicians, honored me by putting me on the cover with a quite lengthy feature article inside. And I'm quite flattered and very honored they had done that. And my good friend Tom Vorjahan just did a spectacular job of writing up this portion of my life and what we do. And so it's an opportunity for you to get to know me a little bit better if you don't know me. And those who do know me, you'll get to know some things perhaps you didn't know about me. There are some odd facts that are scattered throughout the article as well. So anyhow, it also, of course, talks about this podcast. And so there are a lot of people who perhaps came to this podcast by reading that article and found out there actually is another magic podcast out there. And I hope that you will then go into the archives and do a little bit of scrolling around and find something that would be of interest to you. I'm confident that you will. So again, welcome to all of our new listeners, as well as everyone else who does come back from week to week. And I appreciate specifically those people who are our financial supporters, those are the ones who will provide us with a donation from time to time or an ongoing financial pledge each month. And you can do that by going through Patreon or through PayPal. If you just go to themagicwordpodcast.com, there you'll see a tab in which you become a friend of the Magic Word. So again, I'm just thrilled, and I want to thank Alan Howard also, who is the editor of the MUM, for putting me on the cover and having this feature. So great. It's wonderful. Thank you guys very much. And if you're not a member of the Society of American Magicians, let me tell you, I think you should join. It's a great organization, and they're going to be having a convention coming up this next year in January in Las Vegas. Again, more information on their website at magicsam.com. Now, another thing had happened this week, and that is I got a quite interesting gift in the mail from Secret Santa, perhaps an unknown person. It is David Copperfield's History of Magic, written by David Copperfield, Richard Wiseman, and David Britlin. The photographs were by Homer Lewag. And let me just say, as someone who has been to the museum three different times on different occasions, each time it's just more impressive. And of course, there's no way you can go through all of the things that are in his museum. It takes hours and hours, days and days, of course. But this would be the closest thing you could probably get to actually the real thing. So for those of you who have not had the opportunity to visit the museum, this book would be the next best thing. There are different ways of ordering your copy. I understand there are some that are out there that are autographed. You can order them through Amazon or Barnes & Noble or elsewhere. I understand there are three different places to order those. If you order through Barnes & Noble, I believe it supposedly has an extra chapter that is not available through other places. Recently, David Copperfield had given an interview and said if you order through whatever link he gave you at that time, he would send you signed copies. So there are some out there that are autographed then as well directly by him. But if you go through Amazon.com, through the website here, if you go to themagicwordpodcast.com, there's a link on this week's blog that will direct you to where you can purchase this directly on Amazon, and you can help us out a little bit because we're an affiliate of Amazon. So there you go. Also, I would suggest while you're there on the blog, you can watch a video from the National Museum of American Jewish History when David Copperfield was inducted to the museum there last December. And I believe at the time he was talking a little bit about his book that was going to be coming up. And so that's whenever I got a pre-order, I believe, around that time. So I got a few bucks off of mine through a pre-order. But anyhow, there are available, and I would highly recommend that you get your copy then today, or have someone you love buy this for you as an early Christmas gift. I just want, again, to let you know, this is a great book. I have gone through this, and the photos that Homer had taken are amazing. And all color photos in here, and for, I don't know, 25 bucks or so, whatever it is, that for the cost of this book, it costs is immaterial compared to the great facts that you get. And it is a history of magic, and he goes through and talks about all many of the different rooms, and he pulls out certain things that are some of his prized things that he has, that David enjoys about his museum. Again, it goes into some detail about that, and it's like walking through the museum with David actually there by your side and telling you something about it. So I can highly recommend this. And while we're on the subject of books, I want to mention one other book that's coming out on Halloween. That's October the 31st again, and that is going to be Eugene Berger, Final Secrets by Lawrence Haas and Eugene Berger. This is the second, I believe, and final book of Larry's, in which he had the first one in 2019. He released some other previously unpublished materials from Eugene, and so now it's time for Eugene Berger's Final Secrets. I understand this is going to include both the text and audio versions of Eugene's 1992 masterpiece, Growing in the Art of Magic. It also provides access to the 27 videos and audio recordings that Eugene did, performing and explaining his card magic and sharing some of his wisdom about reaching towards excellence in the art. And I understand, again, this is in stock and will be available for delivery on this Sunday, on the 31st, and runs about $120. So it's about $90 more than what the Copperfield book is, but you get the wisdom of Eugene Berger. Two completely different books, and two recommendations there if you're looking for something that you want to read, enjoy, and to learn from, and see some wonderful pictures, as I said, that Homer Lewag had taken there of Copperfield's collection. Also, this week, when we talked with John Cox, we were recording that on video. And so if you, again, go to the website or go to the YouTube channel on Texas Magician, that's youtube.com/Texas Magician, or just do a search for Scott Wells, I believe you will find this video. And it was there were some things we talk about during our conversation in which we were holding up things and showing things. Well, we give a description of that for the people who are listening to the audio portion of this, but if you go to the YouTube video, you will see that what we were talking about. So it is another way of enhancing your enjoyment of this podcast by seeing the video that accompanies this then as well. So there are a lot of things, again, we want to talk about in this podcast, and I'm going to quickly get into this, but one last thing. I do want to say that this week's episode is brought to you by the NEMCA Virtual Online Convention. That is the New England Magic Collectors Association, a virtual convention that's going to be on Saturday, November the 6th, and they are our sponsor here this week, and they have also got a longer audio advertisement on the Magic Convention Guide page. If you go to that website, you can see it there. And for any other organizations who would like to have their convention spotlighted, like we're doing with NEMCA, you can drop me an email, and I will give you information on how that you can be included with that on our podcast. Well, enough on the front end. A lot of stuff been going on, and I want to thank, again, everybody for coming in and listening to this week's episode, because we are recognizing the 95th anniversary of the death of Harry Houdini, who had died on Halloween. That's October 31st in 1926. And who better than to tell us a little bit about all things Houdini than my good friend, who is the blogger for wildabouthoudini.com, Mr. John Cox, here on The Magic Order. This month is Magic Month, the whole month of October. We're celebrating magic. And on October 31st is known as National Magic Day, actually. And perhaps one of the reasons is because that is what we know as the day when Harry Houdini had died. And so today we have with us a noted Houdini file and fan and collector of everything Houdini. Plus, he has wildabouthoudini.com or the Wild About Harry blog that he's well known for. Please welcome my good friend, Mr. John Cox. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. I am the Headless Horseman.
The Great Pumpkin.
a nice visual gag for a podcast. So all you people that didn't know what just happened, I was holding a little Halloween pumpkin mask up to my face.
Over your face. Yeah, that will encourage people maybe to go to the YouTube channel and see that then as well.
Yes, for sure.
There might be some other visual things we'll talk about. So this is interesting because a long time ago, and you could probably give me the history of this, why is it and when was it that Halloween was designated as National Magic Day?
You know, good question.
I'm guessing it has something to do with the SAM.
Yeah, shortly after Houdini's death. But that's a good question. I don't know for sure if it started right away or if that was something that came a little bit later, because the idea of National Magic Day wasn't just to honor Houdini. It's actually National Magic Week. And it, so it's the whole week, and SAM magicians, you know, do good deeds. They perform for hospitals and stuff like that. So the idea is to sort of honor Houdini by honoring magic volunteering and using that week to do good in the name and memory of Houdini. And I don't know exactly when that happened. There's actually a page on the SAM website that tells the history of National Magic Week, and I'm sure it's there.
And one of the reasons, of course, the SAM was so involved with that and getting it started up, I assume, was because Harry Houdini was so instrumental in the early days of the SAM and being one of its past national presidents, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, Houdini, you know, sometimes people make the mistake saying that Houdini founded the SAM. He didn't. SAM, you know, was founded around 1902-ish, I think. And Houdini was an early member, but he actually dropped out of the SAM.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he wanted the SAM to make his magazine, Conjurers Monthly, that he was publishing from like 1906 to 1908. He wanted that to be their official magazine, and he was pushing for that very hard. Part of the reason is that he just really didn't get along with Dr. A.M. Wilson, who published The Sphinx, which was their national magazine. They really did not get along initially.
Okay.
And for that reason, probably for other things, Houdini was also in 1908 going to Europe, and he knew he was going to be there for many years. He actually resigned from the SAM.
Hmm.
And about a year later, though, they made him an honorary member. But he was sort of done with it. He went to England. He helped found the Magicians Club. But when he came back in the teens and sort of got marooned in the United States because of the war, he had to just tour the United States and Canada. He ended up, getting involved with the SAM again. He made peace with Dr. A.M. Wilson. And he decided, you know, and he always wanted the SAM. He had a vision. He loved the idea of a national magic fraternity, something, you know, modeled on, you know, like the Masons or the Shriners, something that was a national organization. The SAM hadn't been that. The SAM was kind of a New York magic club, and there were magic clubs everywhere. And Houdini really wanted this idea of a national organization. So he and Oscar Thiel really got working on it. As he toured, he met with all the local magic clubs. He told them, you should really come under the SAM umbrella. Let's build this organization. And he went about doing that over the course of a couple years. And for his trouble, was nominated and elected president of the SAM. So the SAM as a national organization does start with Houdini. It was Houdini's vision to have all these chapters and what have you. And so, you know, the most illustrious president, because he really is the guy who made the SAM into the national organization that it still is today.
And when you said he formed the Magic Club, and that was in England when he was over there, you said?
The Magician's Club, yeah. When he went to, and he wanted a fraternity. He wanted, a magic club modeled on other fraternal organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, with Will Goldstone, he helped form the Magicians Club in London. He was vice president. Goldstone was president. And so he sort of was trying to bring that vision to the UK, where he spent so much time.
And then you say he was marooned in the U.S., meaning during World War One, he was here raising money for war bonds and everything, too, as I recall.
Yeah, you know, I mean, he came back to the U.S. I mean, his early career was he jumped back and forth between the United States and Europe. And in 1914, he came back and had plans in 1915 to actually tour the world. He was finally, you know, after his mother's death, he was sort of freed up. He didn't want to travel too much when she was still alive. Oh. He didn't want to be too far away from her. But after she died, he realized, you know, I can finally sort of branch out. And he actually had plans to tour through Asia. It's wild. He was building some sort of a supercar that would fold open into a whole stage. And he was actually going to travel all through China and Japan and Russia in this thing. He had this great plan. So he comes back to the United States in 1914, and that's when war breaks out in Europe. And so suddenly the world has closed off to him, and 1915 instead, he does a tour of the United States. And really from that point until 1920, he's unable to travel the world because of the war. And so he's here in the U.S., and that's when he really kind of settles into his U.S. life. You know, he moves back into 278. That really becomes his home now. And he gets, involved with the SAM and decides, I want this to be what I always imagined it could be, and you guys would never get together.
Was he traveling quite a bit and performing during that time, I guess, of the war? I mean, when I said I knew he was raising money for war bonds and everything, but did the country embrace him at the time because they were anxious and looking for some outlet? I mean, all they knew about, I guess, from the news reports were what was coming from Germany and the war that was going on over there. And so I assume that he was popular and still traveling during the war and performing.
Yes and no. You know, so the war starts in 1914 in Europe.
Right.
America isn't involved yet. And he's just touring around the United States and Canada at that time. Takes a big tour 1915 into 1916. Mm-hmm. But as soon as America and then he winds up at the Hippodrome doing his Vanishing Elephant. But when America enters into the war, he's all in, baby. He's like, you know, this is a fight we must win. And he actually turns down a very lucrative tour in 1917, I think, and instead devotes himself completely to the war effort. So he performs at camps, he performs at charities, he sells bonds, mm-hmm. he devotes himself to the war. And that's how it goes. And what's kind of neat, I love these connections, because he does that, one of the things he does, he organizes a lot of benefits. And the Antilles was a catastrophe that happened early in the war, a transport ship that was torpedoed. And Houdini arranges this big benefit for the families of the Antilles casualties, mm-hmm. at the New York Hippodrome. And he brings in Harry Keller and he does this fabulous show at the Hippodrome. And the head of the Hippodrome says, you know, I'm impressed with you know, how you put that together in this show. Why don't you join Cheer Up, which is my next big review show, and, you know, come up with something spectacular? And that's when and why Houdini develops the Vanishing Elephant.
Oh, okay.
So he stays in New York at the Hippodrome during the Vanishing Elephant all through 1918, does a tour. And that's when he also gives the troops lessons in how to escape German handcuffs and rope ties and stuff like that. So it's sort of this idea that he won't tour, he'll just do charity, that then gets the attention of the Hippodrome and leads to the Vanishing Elephant. So it's sort of neat how these connections are made. But he stays pretty much in New York during all this time, and that also allows him to make his movies and stuff like that.
But the movies he was making, I thought, were in Hollywood. No?
Well, his first one, The Master Mystery, he does in New Jersey. So okay. 1918, it's a big year. He's doing The Vanishing Elephant. He's teaching soldiers how to escape from handcuffs. And he's filming The Master Mystery in New Jersey.
Wait a minute. I didn't know he was teaching soldiers how to escape from handcuffs. That's pretty cool. Interesting.
That's one of the things he did. He invited soldiers to come to the Hippodrome, and he would give classes in how to escape from German handcuffs, how to escape from restraints. And, yeah, he really did that.
Wow. Wow, that was important stuff for those guys to know back then as well, should they get captured or something. Wow, there's so many different directions and everything that we can go, obviously, with talking about what's happening with Houdini. One of the things I was going to ask you about also is about the seances. Of course, you and I had been involved in one in Fort Worth many years ago. Are they still continuing to do seances to this date? Are they planning one here this year for 2021?
Yeah. The seances continue. You know, the official Houdini seance was the one that we did in Fort Worth. That was great. And they are going to do it. They did it virtually last year. Mm-hmm. I actually just talked to Bill Radner, and he said it is going to be it's not going to be virtual. They're going to do an in-person seance, but it's going to be a private one. It's going to be held in Chicago. But, you know, the tradition continues. The official Houdini seances continue.
Well, they have done that as a private event for a long time leading up to the one. I think the one they did in Fort Worth was because everyone wanted to see Arthur Moses' collection, and then Arthur opened it up to everyone then as well. So it had been private kind of on and off for many years. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, they go back and forth. Sometimes it's private or kind of invite only. Sometimes it's a big public event. You know, they did a big one in San Francisco not long after Fort Worth. So it depends on the year and what they can pull together and what kind of – and sometimes they'll hand it off to someone. Like the year that we did it, Arthur decided to take charge of it. And so mm-hmm. that was sort of Arthur worked with them to create this grand – public event, and then that happened in San Francisco. So sometimes it's a big event that the public can go to, and sometimes it's a smaller event. So it's going to be smaller this year from what they've told me.
And it's some of the same guys. Well, they are the same fellows pretty much year after year. Can you name the people who are involved in that?
Well, Bill Radner, son of Sidney Radner, because Sid Radner was the guy who started these seances in mid-70s.
It was mostly collection also that was at Niagara Falls. Isn't that correct?
The Niagara Falls Museum was a combo. It was mostly Henry Mueller who ran the museum. He had bought Dunninger's collection, mm-hmm. And so a lot of it was the Dunninger collection, Henry's collection. And then, but Sid did loan items on a permanent loan, the water torture cell and some other things. So it was a hybrid of Henry's Dunninger collection and items from Sid's collection.
Okay. So I didn't mean to interrupt, but so Bill Radner, son of Sid Radner, is one of the people who's involved. And who else?
He now carries it on. Bill Radner carries it on along with Tom Bolt. Tom Bolt has always kind of been the man behind the scenes, helping organize these things. Tom is wonderful.
Yeah. Now, yeah. Throughout the years, there have been, you know, you've been doing your blog on wildabouthoudini.com for how many years? 8 years?
No, this is the 11th year.
11th year, okay.
And that's just this blog. I had an earlier website called Houdini Lives that I don't know. Maybe I started in 2005 or so. But Wild About Harry is going to be 11 years old sometime in November. I think it's like November 10th or something is the anniversary.
Be 11 years old. Yeah. And during that time, when I assume by this point people are sending you information. It's just not you going out and finding things all the time. But the obvious question is, and I've asked you before when we were sitting down in your home there and I was chatting, was how do you come up with something every day? I mean, that you're uncovering. It's amazing.
It is amazing. I don't know. You know, and I don't try to post every day. And in fact, lately I haven't been. I think that's one of the problems is that I post too much. You know, stuff gets buried too quickly. So I would love to give something a few days to sit there, but there's just so much, you know?
Yeah.
And it's strange. It's just a combination of things. Yeah, people sometimes send me stuff but not so much as research. I mean, if someone has some original research, I'll ask them to write it up as their own guest blog. And do it. It will be more. They've got an item, or you know, something like that. But a lot of it's just my own daily research. This past week, it was the 95th anniversary of my Houdini window card, which you mm-hmm. can see behind me. Houdini performing in Providence, and I said, you know, I want to try and find a review of that show. And I was able to kind of find the Providence Journal archive and find a review, but then that sent me down this Providence rabbit hole.
Wow.
And I realized, you know, Houdini performed in Providence 10 times. Let's see what he did here. And I've discovered all this cool stuff. And he bought a new car in Providence. And it's like, here's what he did. And here's what the theater looks like today. And I don't know. Somehow it comes. I'm waiting for that week where it's like, there's nothing. I don't have anything. There's nothing happening. But that is just certainly has not been the case. There is always something going on that I can post about.
And you have some things that are in reserve, so this way you keep a few days at least, or maybe weeks ahead?
I've almost always had about 30 posts in one form or another, yeah. You know, in a draft form, not finished. Some stuff sort of started, not finished, or some stuff in reserve. It's like, you know, I've been throwing out a lot of historical stuff. I'm going to kind of hold some back. And so I do, but that reserve has actually gone way down. You know, I've had a very, very busy year with real world work. So
right.
I haven't been able to dive into I'm doing an ongoing series where I'm taking every scene of Houdini 1953, the great Tony Curtis biopic,
yeah.
And just deep diving into the scene, you know,
wow.
dissecting it. And I like doing that, but that's a lot of work. And so I haven't been able to really do those as much as I wanted to. So my reserves are actually pretty low. It pretty much is kind of what I find on the spot, whether or not it goes up. But I'm not holding myself to a I gotta post every day. I'm happy to not post and let people enjoy. And there's plenty to look for. There's 11 years worth of stuff. Trust me, there's plenty there for you to find.
All in the archives. I know how many hours it takes me just to post a 1-hour podcast each week. And so I can only imagine about how much time that it takes you on a daily basis to continue to work with what you do for the blog to be posted. It just takes so much time, I'm sure, in addition to your regular full-time job. I would think it's almost impossible.
Well, you've got a harder job because I've done a few things that are sort of audiovisual, and that's a lot of work, editing, and that takes time. It doesn't take me long at all to whip up a post. I mean, it's writing, it's putting in pictures. I mean, I can, you know, do some quick research. I'm surprised at how quickly I can throw these things up.
People have often asked me if they're going to be getting involved in this Magic Word podcast, what do I recommend to them would be a good one or two for them to listen to, saying, oh, that's great, I'm hooked, I want to listen to more. What are some of the blog posts that you have posted over the last 11 years that have perhaps resonated most with in your analytics that show that people are really reading or that you recommend?
Ah, that's good. That's a good question. What would I recommend? You know, I mean, I would have to feel them out. It's like what area of Houdini interests you? You know,
yeah.
is it do you want to read reviews of modern movies? Are you into his spiritualism? Do you want an unknown escape? You know, what's your knowledge level too? You know,
mm-hmm.
It's like if you kind of have seen it all, well, I can show you some stuff that I think you haven't seen or didn't know. So it sort of depends more, I think, on the person than what I would recommend. Some of the stats are very strange. There's this one post I did where I kind of gathered together all the fragments of his. There's this film of him doing an overboard box escape,
mm-hmm.
That I still cannot identify when and where this was done. And there are fragments of it in different documentaries. And I kind of assembled the fragments into one clip and put it up. Gosh, that thing gets so much traffic.
Hmm.
I don't know what's going on. I'm sometimes suspicious that maybe it's caught in some kind of spam machine or something.
Mm-hmm.
But the amount of traffic that draws is very, very strange. I don't know what's going on with that post, but it's always like in my top 10. By the way, I have a much more complete footage from that escape, which I'm going to put up in the next couple weeks. So that one's strange. People are always going, I've got a post, here is J. Gordon Whitehead. And people go to that post all the time because it's because people are Googling it. Oh, the kid who punched Houdini was named Gordon Whitehead. They'll Google it and they'll land on that post. It's not a particularly impressive post, but That's what people tend to find. So it tends to, the stats tend to reflect a lot just what people land on. Here's a post that never dies. Pawn Stars, you know, they did their episode about Houdini's straitjacket. I can always tell when that thing has repeated because all of a sudden there'll be all this traffic to that post. And I'm like, okay. But that's what the blog is. And that's what I love because I've always said, you know, if someone is just sitting on their couch and they're like, huh, Houdini, that's interesting. They don't say, I think I'll go to a library and find a book from 1960 and read about him. They just Google. And yeah. I want them to land on some good stuff. And I'm happy to see when they land on my blog because that's the rabbit hole, man. You can go right down.
Easily to go down. That's true. Now, on Pawn Stars, by the way, is that the one where Murray Sawchuk was the resident expert? I know he's on Pawn Stars a lot.
Yeah, he came in. Yeah, it was a straitjacket.
Yeah,
this was amazing. I mean, because no one knew that this existed. This was the real thing. Some guy brought in a straitjacket that his family had had and that he played with as a kid. And Houdini's brother, Hardeen, had given it to his father. And Murray and the show, they did a great job of authenticating it. They were really able to get in there and see that there was one stitch that wasn't quite right. And they could match that to the photo of Houdini doing the escape in Los Angeles. They got the location of the photo wrong, by the way. It was the Los Angeles 1923 Los Angeles escape that they were using that photo. But they were able to absolutely authenticate this as a Houdini straitjacket that he used in his suspended straitjacket escapes. It's the first one that's ever really been, you know, he had a lot of straitjackets, but this is you couldn't argue with that stitch. So it was well done. It was well done on all levels.
Do you have any recollection as to how much that actually went for? The Pawn Stars sold it for in the store?
Well, Rick made his offer. I don't remember the dollar amounts. You know, this is what people are Googling because they want to know what happened to it. But luckily, sure. I did follow it. So Rick made some sort of an offer. You know, in the 20 to 30, I don't remember what he offered. But the answer was no. And it ended up going, and the guy ended up putting it on eBay for an obscene amount of money. This is always what happens. You know, they put it up for $100,000 or something. No one's going to touch it.
Right.
But it ended up going up for auction out of the UK, I think, and did sell, I think, for like $46,000.
Wow.
Yeah. I shouldn't quote the amounts because I don't remember exactly. Well, but it's all on my site. But yeah, it ended up selling in auction for a lot of money. Not to David Copperfield. David Copperfield doesn't have that one. I don't know who got this one.
I know Copperfield does have one of the water torture cells, which one of them, of course, was burned up in that fire in Niagara Falls. And I've seen some pieces of that that people have in their collection where it's like pieces of glass or the charred wood or whatever from that someone was selling as well. But I didn't know that there were two of them. I thought there was only the one, and when it was gone, it's gone. Then when I was at Copperfield's Museum, it's like, oh, there's one. What's that doing here?
Well, that's the whole story. One of those pieces of glass I have sitting right up on my case.
How cool
I would
is that?
Stand up, but I can't with the headphones on. No, Copperfield's is the one that was in the museum.
Oh,
the museum burned, and the torture cell burned down to the frame, but the frame survived, and John Gaughan then restored it using the frame, using everything that had survived. He restored it. And that's what sold in auction to David Copperfield.
So it's not the original glass. Again, that wasn't tempered glass. It broke. And then I guess that's the piece that you have there, too.
I had heard. Yeah. So the glass broke. But I had heard there was a reserve pane of glass that Houdini had. And maybe that's what's on the cell. But I'm not too sure about that. The cell went through a couple restorations. So it was in the museum for many years and it got trashed. Henry put a fish tank inside of it at one point to kind of give it a bubbly effect. And the fish tank leaked and ruined it. It was in bad shape. And so in the 90s, they sent it to John Gaughan, and John Gaughan did a full refurbishment on it, made it look beautiful. They put it back in the museum. And there it stayed for a couple of years, and then the fire happened, and it was destroyed. Mm-hmm. And so they took those pieces, sent it back to John Gaughan, who had done the refurbishment, so he really knew all, you know, what to do. And so he was able to rebuild it. So he rebuilds it. It sells an auction. From what I understand, though, David Copperfield had his people strip it back down because it looked a little too new. Uh-huh. He wanted to restore it with 100-year-old wood and the whole thing. And so his cell now, it sort of has that that good aged look. He wanted to bring it back to the time as much as he could. So it's seen a lot of restoration in action, but it's still, the frame is the original. And, you know, I'm not sure what the story with the stocks is. I hear different things about that the stocks maybe weren't in the fire, that those are the original stocks. I don't know. The story on the water torture cell, it's loaded with twists and turns, but everything that's original is in David's cell, except for some pieces that seem to have gotten out and have been sold.
I know that Copperfield, of course, has the bookcase from Houdini's house in New York, and I've never seen you, John, more excited nor happy than when you got to go to New York and see inside Houdini's house and all the things, and the things you were posting about that, and just the pictures of you. It's like, this is amazing. And then getting to stand beside the bookcase and everything there as well. That's quite a story.
That was amazing. Of all the, I think that's the high point so far of having this blog, high point of my Houdini life, because 278, I mean, that's a holy place. And you couldn't get in there. I mean, the gentleman who owned it, you know, he was private.
Sure.
It was his home. And all you could do is stand outside and look at it. And I just, to be in that house would be something. And it goes up for sale. And I find out it's listed, and I'm like, whoa, and there's an open house coming up.
Yeah.
And I got a hold of, and I thought, am I crazy enough to fly to New York just to go to an open house? And yes. I don't know. So I wanted to feel it out. And so I sent an email to the realtor and said, hey, I run a blog and blah, blah, blah. And she says, oh, yeah, no, I know your website. It's been really helpful. She says, you should come to the open house. In fact, come early. I'll let you in and I'll give you kind of a tour of areas that aren't going to be open and everything. And then it's like, it's on. I'm going to New York. Boom. I went, had the experience. It was wonderful. You know, figured that would be my one and only experience inside the house. I really expected someone to buy it and maybe gut it and you know, turn it into a modern dwelling, but no, it was. And when I was in there, I saw the bookcase. Now people weren't making this connection at this point. Mm-hmm. I saw that bookcase, and I'm like, ooh, that is Houdini's bookcase. That's in that famous picture. Mm-hmm. And we're all taking pictures by the bookcase, and we're all excited about the bookcase. And what's interesting, at the time, the realtor was very much, the bookcase stays, very like almost like it was a hassle. It's like, yeah, whoever buys this house is stuck with that bookcase. Well, the bookcase did not stay. Once I started posting about it, there was a second open house that happened, and people got a hold of me, and they said, you know what? The bookcase is gone. It's not in the house anymore. And I'm like, oh, wow. Really? That's interesting. And I wasn't getting – but I didn't know what was going on. And that's when David Copperfield got a hold of me. That's how I got a hold of David Copperfield. You know, that's how we connected. Mm-hmm. And he just said, I want you to kind of know what's going on. He said, I bought the bookcase and so this is what's going on, but you know, the house needs to sell and everything needs to settle, but I wanted you to have the information. And then, you know, when the house is sold, we can put it up and have fun. So I thought that was really cool of him. And at that point he invited me to see his museum. So yes, the bookcase is now in Copperfield's museum. And what's so great about that is that, you know, he had all these books of Houdini's that he got from the John Mulholland collection. Mm-hmm. So he was able to return those books to the bookcase, you know, and he even looked carefully at the photograph to see if we can actually put the original books back
in the same order.
In the same order, yeah. Wow. So, yeah, so the bookcase, that was exciting. But then the house gets bought by this wonderful couple who are so excited to have Houdini's house. Their ambition was to buy a brownstone that they could restore. They're not going to gut. They didn't gut it. They restored it. It's now more Houdini's house than ever. They're generous. They're wonderful. They're fun. You know, I they've given me an open invitation to visit anytime. I could even sleep in the house, they said, if I wanted to. I'm like, oh,
have you?
So Not yet. Not yet. I'm dying to. I'll be going to New York. They said you got to do it. They said you should come and live here. They're so nice. Just move in. Yeah, it's a huge house. Be our resident.
And they don't have any children. It's just the two of them, the husband and wife. And
no, they do have children.
Okay. Wow. Yeah.
But they've been really fun, and they're really kind of getting involved in the Houdini community.
I was about to say, were they involved at all, or did they know the providence of the house is why they bought it, or is it just kind of like, hey, that's convenient, I like the size and like the rooms and the layout or whatever? I mean, architecturally, they liked it from that standpoint. It's like, oh, Houdini happened to live here too, no big deal to them. I want to take a break here for just a moment to talk about Harry Houdini. We've been talking about him and someone who is legendary in our art and someone's very important. And a lot of people collect things related to Harry Houdini, as well as other kinds of things related to magic. And in fact, next weekend, we're going to be having a convention that will be all about magic collectors. That's the New England Magic Collectors Association, or NEMCA. And I've got with me right now the vice president of NEMCA, Mike Mayo. Hi there, Michael.
How you doing, Scott?
Fantastic, sir. Thank you very much. So tell me something about NEMCA. What's happening? What are the dates, or the date, and what's going on?
NEMCA is putting on the virtual Yankee Gathering 2021. It's happening Saturday, November 6th, and it's going to be an all-day online convention. Starts at about 10 in the morning Eastern time and ends at about 9 for us.
Wow, that's great. And because it is going to be online, I know during this pandemic, so many people, of course, now know how to use Zoom and probably have cameras and all of the necessary equipment in order to view these kinds of things. And so this will be accessible to any and everyone throughout the world.
That's right, Scott. It's on a platform called the Cell Events, which is very easy to use. It's built specifically for online conventions. So you can view it anywhere in the world. And also, because of the time zones, we're keeping the content available for 7 days after the date of the convention that you can go back and rewatch anytime.
That sounds great. So how would people get to register for the convention?
If you go on our website, NEMCA.com, NEMCA.com, there's a short article with a link to the Cell Events registration page. And you can go to that page, check out some of the speakers and the tours that we're going to have and some of the other contents of the convention and sign up from there.
Now, because the platform that you're using is a little bit different from Zoom, I assume there are ways in which the registrants can interact with each other as well as the lecturers and performers.
Absolutely. They have during each lecture, they have a chat feature. And also we have virtual lounges. With different themed rooms that people can go in and discuss magic specific topics or advertise their business or something for sale and whatnot. And that's all on the platform. There's no need to go to Zoom.
And I assume with the dealers, it'll be mostly related to collectible kinds of things related to magic.
Yes, actually, our whole convention is sponsored by Haversat and Ewing Galleries. Galleries are going to be running an auction for us later in the day, actually.
That sounds like a whole lot of fun. And again, beginning at 10 o'clock in the morning, that's Eastern time, and then running all day.
What we have is six lectures and three tours of magical collections.
Okay, gotcha. And it wraps up approximately what time?
By the end of the, we have some breakout discussion groups at the end of the evening. That should wrap up around 9.
I see. Sounds like a fun time.
It's started by Ray Goulet and Ed Hill. Years ago. We're the longest running magic history organization.
So it's been decades, actually. Yeah.
Oh, 40 years now. Yes, Scott.
40 years. Well, yeah. It's been around for a long time. Well, as collectors should be. So that's great. Well, thanks, Mike. That sounds like a fun time. And I recommend everybody to go and check that out. And everybody can attend and should attend NEMCA. That's NEMCA.com.
Thanks, Scott.
You bet. And good luck with the convention.
Thanks.
I was about to say, were they involved at all, or did they know the providence of the house is why they bought it, or is it just kind of like, hey, that's convenient, I like the size and like the rooms and the layout or whatever? I mean, architecturally, they liked it from that standpoint. It's like, oh, Houdini happened to live here too, no big deal to them.
Yeah, it was, well, you know, I'll tell you something really interesting. So they were really looking for a brownstone that they loved the idea of a brownstone that they could restore. And so this was the one, and the fact that it was Houdini's house, what they thought was pretty cool, but it wasn't a selling point for them, but they thought that was neat. And they've continued to get more and more excited about that. But here's a crazy coincidence. So they buy Houdini's house. I came to New York. I did a lecture about Houdini locations, and they were there. And one of the locations I show is Mrs. Leffler's boarding house, which was the first place Houdini ever lived in New York. His family moved into this boarding house. Mm-hmm. It's now a restaurant, or the bottom floor is a restaurant whose name I forget. They were like, oh my God, that's where we met. That was the site of our first date, in that restaurant.
Oh, wow.
In the first place Houdini ever lived. And then they end up buying Houdini's house. I'm telling you, it's stuff like that that makes you kind of believe, boy, there feels like there's something larger at work here. Houdini is guiding us all. And, you know, he guided them to his house, because his house, it's amazing that it has survived. It has gone through some rough times, man. But for it now to be back to what it was, and such a place of you know, honoring Houdini, you know, with these people who love the history of it. They have a little corner of Houdini artifacts that they had.
Oh, found. Do they? Okay.
Yeah. So it's just it's back to being Houdini's house.
Well, and what part of New York City is this? So that's in Harlem area, or where is it?
It's in Harlem, yeah. Yeah, about like two blocks or so right up from the top of Central Park.
And another interesting thing, I think, then, who most listeners who pay attention to the podcast, particularly have been following your column, certainly know that as they were remodeling that, some of the wood was taken and then was made into some really cool stuff. Can you talk about that guy who did that and how he came about making what he has been making?
Yes, the wood. I'm happy to, because, you know, this is growing into its own, its own story. So what happened? So when they were, they did some substantial remodeling and improvements to the house. And one of the things they did, they had to tear out some of the bathroom walls to put in modern plumbing and whatnot. And at some point I told them, maybe when I was there, I said, don't throw away any of the wood or anything. I said, you know, believe it or not, I think it's valuable. I was sort of thinking, I think you could like sell pieces of it, like stamp it, sell pieces of it on eBay for $25 or something. But I said, you should save it. And they're like, okay, we will. And so they amassed this giant pile of wood in the basement. And one morning, you know, they get a hold of me and they said, you know, the big city dumpster is here out front, and it's going to be here for a week. They said, we can't do anything with this wood. We've got to get it. We need to toss it out. So they said, if you want to just put it out on your blog that it exists, maybe some people want to come and take it away, and we'll make them they can buy it for a nothing price. But they said, just, you know, it's going. We're throwing mm-hmm. it out. And so I put it up on my blog that morning. I'm like, hey, 278 wood. I mean, if there's any entrepreneurs out there, it would be awesome to get. You could make things. And the first guy to step up with was Barry Spector. And Barry was actually with me in that open house. Barry and I were together for that private tour. So Barry steps right up, goes there. He's a real master woodworker. And so he took a lot of the wood, and he became very good friends with the homeowners. He's actually helped them with some of their remodeling. And he got a lot of wood. Some other people came in and got some wood. You know, they made some money off that too. That went right back into the restoration. So that's great. And yes, Barry and other people have just made these marvelous creations. Barry especially. He started with magic wands, which I thought was just a great idea.
Yep.
I think in my original post, I said someone should make magic wands. Barry made wands. He gave me wand number one. I have wand number one. But he's gone on to make all these other things. Other people have made pins, their cufflinks. So there's all this Ouija board.
I have one of the Ouija boards.
You have one of the Ouija boards?
The smaller one.
You know, the small one's nice. I like that.
Yeah.
You know, Houdini hated Ouija boards. You know, part of me is like, you know, Houdini wouldn't have dug that. And Houdini was asked specifically on more than one occasion what he thought of Ouija boards. And he said, the Ouija board is the first step to the insane asylum. He thought it was a gateway drug into spiritualism, and spiritualism made people insane. So he wouldn't have loved that his pieces of his house were made into Ouija boards. But they're really well done, and they're pretty cool.
Yeah.
So people have been making these things. And, you know, that's another thing that makes me happy about this blog, is that That all started on that day that they said, it's going in the trash. Why don't you throw the word out? And I did. And that's the cool. best thing, you know, that my dream was always stuff can be done with this wood. I mean, this is precious stuff.
Sure.
And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, lots of dreams came true and people got wonderful artifacts and people made money and wonderful.
Wow. Well, speaking of artifacts, by the way, down through the years, there have been a lot of really cool things that have the Houdini name on it. I know that the families and heirs of many other people, let's say, like, I don't know, Abbott and Costello or the Three Stooges or whomever, Sherlock Holmes even, have really put a lid on what things can have their image on it or not. And I know that Houdini in some cases, well, I mean, for example, I know the people who are not watching this on YouTube right now, but I've got a bottle of Houdini beer. And this was, Houdini Escape Stout is what this is. And this only lasted for a short time because apparently, of course, he was a teetotaler. And Houdini, I guess, heirs or whomever said, you know, that shouldn't be made and it didn't give him approval. And so they don't make that stuff any longer.
I've never seen that particular beer. There was another brand of Houdini beer that was brewed in Appleton or brewed in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And I have a case of that, but I've never seen that stout. I've not heard that story because as far as I know, no one has any ownership of Houdini's name. Even the family, you know, he has no direct family. Mm-hmm. There's George Hardeen, who's related to Hardeen.
He had a nephew though, right? Or niece?
Well, niece is a nephew, but it's on Bessie's. It's on Bessie's side.
Oh, okay.
Got it. There's Bessie's family, which was the, you know, the Hinsons. And the Bloods now, and then there's Hardeen's family, which is George Hardeen and his sister, and so. But there's no direct Houdini relation because they never had kids.
Yeah.
And so no one has ever formed an estate. Marie Blood told me, you know, she said, you know, lawyers have come to me and told me I should do this, but her thing was I'm not going to do it. I want Uncle Harry to belong to the world, and that appears to be the same thinking, which is nice. Although, you know, I sometimes feel like with stuff like the Adrian Brody History Channel biopic, right, and stuff, mm-hmm, like that, they should get a little something. If not for Houdini, for the portrayal of Bess, which is not a very flattering portrayal, it's like, you know, They should have. I feel like the family should get a little something for stuff like that. But that's just my thinking. But I don't know what the legalities of any of that is. But you don't need, as far as I know, you don't need any permission to use Houdini's name, and everyone does. There's this whole line of kitchenware called Houdini.
Houdini, right?
Which I don't like. See, I don't like that because it doesn't honor Houdini at all. It's now just Houdini kitchenware. It's like, oh, you know that name. But it isn't, you know, it started as a little bit of a tie-in, you know, oh, a miracle corkscrew, Houdini. Right. Mm-hmm. And now it's just kitchenware. You go in a Target, here's the Houdini section of kitchenware. It's like, Houdini isn't kitchenware. So I sort of don't like that. I would be like, you should shut down the kitchenware, people. I think they're just using the recognizability of the name to sell their wares. They're not honoring Houdini. Put Houdini's picture in there or something. If I owned Houdini's name, I would be tough on people like that. But others, it's like, go for it.
Yeah.
Honor Houdini. Make your beer. Make your Ouija boards.
A lot of really cool stuff.
It honors Houdini, and it specifically, this is, you know, related to Houdini. Then
well, of course, one of the things they had a few years ago were the stamps of Houdini,
yeah,
that came out. I got just a few of those as well. And then they even had the Houdini teddy bear. And everything from the post office that was available, and it was popular. And then, of course, on the stamp, I think this is the first stamp that if you had this little looking glass, you could see the chains that were on the stamp.
I know I've never seen those change. I never had one of those little looking things. So
really?
I've never seen it. Well, the stamp, talk about honoring Houdini. Wasn't that wonderful? Houdini gets a U.S. poacher's stamp. You know, Sid Radner pushed for that very, very, very hard. He was always sort of.
So did Gary Grant, apparently.
Cary Grant, really?
Yep. I was told this many years ago, back when he was involved with the Magic Castle, that they said several celebrities were trying to get this push forward. And this would have been back in the 80s, I believe, because I was living in Midland and my friend is George W. Bush and in Midland. And so I said, well, maybe I can get something to his dad, who was president at the time, to see if he could have some influence. I sent him a letter and with the information that the SAM had given me about why that this stamp should be struck and all the things that Houdini had done specifically, like we talked about with the raising money for the bonds, as well as on movie, motion picture studio, et cetera, et cetera. Anyhow, I had a lengthy letter that I had sent to, given to George, and he gave to his dad. I got a letter back from the president with a presidential seal on it, handwritten by him, and he said, this is really out of my purview. It's the Postmaster General who makes the decisions. However, if I was going to design a stamp, it would look like this. And it had, he drew a box and then kind of squiggly lines around it, and it was empty, and he said, he's disappeared. Or he's escaped.
Wait, that was, you have that letter from George W. Bush?
From his father, George, H. Bush.
The first, okay. H,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a wonderful presidential Ed Houdini heart effect.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
I always liked him. I always liked the senior Bush.
But as a result, nothing really ever happened with that. And it wasn't until a few years later that the stamp actually got struck. But I often think,
it took a while. There were a few campaigns. I know I found a few newspaper articles where, you know, Houdini is one of the people being considered for a postage stamp. Mm-hmm. It took a while, but it finally happened. And it's a beautiful stamp. And then, but they very quickly raised the price of postage. This is back before the forever stamps.
Yeah.
So I think that's like a 32 cent stamp.
37 cent stamp, I believe it is.
37. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they raised postage pretty quickly after that.
Right after, that's right.
Yeah, you had to buy the penny stamps to continue using it.
Now, here was another little thing. Again, I know people can't see this because, but I'm going to show this if you're watching on the on there. And this was something that came from Appleton, and it was a key in a block that has Houdini's signature on it and says something to the effect of it's the key that what is that? Oh, man,
Mere handcuff key. It looks like to me.
Is that right? Is that what that looks like?
It looks like it.
Okay. But yeah, it says dedication of Houdini with his signature, and it's engraved in this block of wood featuring the Radnor Collection of Harry Houdini Memorabilia and Otagami Museum, April 6, 1989, Appleton, Wisconsin. Anyhow, I don't know what the wood itself was, but the point I was going to get to on this, I understand many years ago the city closed the museum and there is no longer a Houdini Museum in Appleton. Is that correct? And what happened to that?
Well, no, there still is. So that was there's always been the museum there in Appleton, and it has different displays. You know, Appleton's a big or that area part of Wisconsin is big on paper. So there's kind of the history of paper mills and stuff like that. There was always a big Houdini area. So there was always a museum in late 80s. They formed, you know, Sid Radnor sent his Houdini collection, his whole collection, to that museum. And that became the Houdini Historical Center. So a huge section of that museum was then the Houdini Historical Center. They had a fabulous display. Sid's collection was there and archived. And so the name of it became, at that point, the Houdini Historical Center, even though it was a museum that had other displays as well.
Okay.
And so, you know, those were great days, but it soured. Things went south. So Sid Radnor pulled out his collection, but the museum itself still had a lot of artifacts that they had bought. They had bought themselves, and so they still have a part of that museum that's devoted to Houdini. A nice display, but it's not anywhere near what it was back in the time of that Sid's collection was there.
I recall also there was an abstract metamorphosis sculpture outside of there, and it seems like I remember a picture of Doug Henning being taken next to that as well. It's been around for a while.
Yeah, well, that was Houdini Plaza.
Oh.
That's it. That's down the street. So that's in downtown Appleton, Houdini's Plaza. It said that's where the Weiss family lived, and they had this great sculpture in the center of it called Metamorphosis, and it was sort of an abstract sculpture. They did a big remodel on Houdini Plaza, the sculpture went into storage, and there's now a new bust there, and it's really cool, but they weren't sure what to do with the sculpture. But they recently reinstalled the sculpture along the banks of the I think it's the Fox River there. So the sculpture lives just in a different area.
They moved it. Interesting.
They moved it. Yeah. After it's sitting for a long time in storage and outside, I kind of have some pictures of it just sitting there. And you know, Tom, again, the man behind the scenes, Tom Bolt, has had a lot to do with all that. Bolt Construction is always involved in these. He makes sure Houdini is well represented in Appleton. And there's a fabulous bust, probably the best bust I've ever seen of Houdini in Houdini Plaza now, him kind of in a straitjacket.
Not like the one, of course, that was on the on his monument, I guess.
That's the best bust of all time, Houdini's original bronze. But this bust that they have in Appleton is gorgeous. It's an original artistic creation.
So speaking of something kind of cool, one of my favorite pieces of my Houdini artifacts is the one I got from Harold Puff many years ago. That was, if I can reach this again, hard to explain or to see on a podcast, but on YouTube you can. This was a plate that he had made, a pewter plate. I know that you've seen this. We've talked about this before, and it's numbered on the back and everything then there too. I got this from him while I was at an IBM convention, and it has Harry Houdini with his birth and date years on that.
Nice. What year is that from?
I believe it was, you know, it doesn't have a, so I'm looking, it does not have any date on it, but I'm going to guess it. You know, it says HP 17, which is Howard Puff or Harold Puff, I believe. It says Canton, Ohio was the date or the where this was forged over there, but there's really no date on it. The date that's on the front is just his birth and death dates, basically, yeah, from this.
Neat, though.
But yeah, just an interesting and different kind of a pewter plate that was kind of cool. And of course, then just for fun, is a bobblehead. Most everybody has to have bobbleheads.
The infamous bobblehead. Yep, I've got a couple of those.
Now, the one we talked about beforehand, you said that you didn't have, but you're going to have to order sometime, would be this cool stein of him and his water torture. Or I'm sorry, not water torture, but the milk can. Milk can. Yeah.
Yeah, I've always liked those. I think those were well done. I don't know why I don't have one of those. Of all the stuff that I should have a Houdini beer stein sitting right here.
Yeah, now that I look at the bottom of this, what does it say over here? That made in Germany. Yeah. This was number 74, limited edition of 500. So that's why I guess there were not that many of them that were made. It says produced exclusively for glasses, mugs, and steins in Sand Prairie, Wisconsin. So Appleton Brewing Company, Appleton, Wisconsin, makers of Houdini beer and root beer.
See, that was the beer we were talking about, and yes, the root beer. Yeah, I have a bottle of that as well.
Well, there you go. Kind of interesting. So, as I said, these are some of the fun collectibles I've got. I love the shirt you're wearing right now. And again, people can't see that unless you watch this on YouTube. A Houdini shirt. Is that a T-shirt? Is that a long sleeve shirt or long sleeve?
This one is long sleeve. I have a T-shirt version. I have long sleeve. What this is Bruce McNabb wrote a fabulous book called The Metamorphosis. Mm-hmm. And it's all about Houdini's ill-fated tour of the Canadian Maritimes in 1897, I think, or 1896. Wait, 1896. I can look on the shirt. What happened was that, you know, this is during his struggling years. Harry and Bessie hooked up with a guy named Marco and joined his troupe, the Marco Magic Show, and they toured the Canadian Maritimes, and the tour was a disaster. Apparently, another magician named Marco had come before them and really bombed, and so that was the beginning of many things that went wrong. So it's an undocumented part of Houdini's life, but Bruce really dove into it and found all these details, not just about the tours and what went on, but also just about this area. It's a fascinating era, and he wrote this great book, Metamorphosis. And he had these shirts made, and they're like Houdini tour shirts. So on the back of it, I can't really turn around. You can kind of see.
Oh, sure. Uh-huh.
On the back is the tour. The date, so it's like a tour shirt, but a lot of them are canceled and crossed out. And it's really clever. So he had a bunch of these made. He'll still give talks, and presumably he sells these at talks. But he sent me a bunch of them, and they're well done.
Do you sell them on your blog, or does he sell them directly, or are they available?
I don't know, actually. I don't know.
Do you have any cool merch that you sell on your blog?
I don't have any merch. No merch.
There should be some stuff. Yeah, there's a way of monetizing there, man. Opportunity.
Yeah, I don't know. Is there enough people that want Wild About Harry t-shirt? I'd like one.
Sure, sure. I would certainly think so. And just you said a lot of people who are tuning in, or I say tune in, but actually download and read this on a daily basis, everything. One other quick question, then also maybe a longer answer, of the kind of memorabilia that you have, what is perhaps one of your most prized possessions? I know it's like asking who's my favorite child, but I mean, there's got to be some pretty cool stuff you like.
Well, let's talk about this, because this podcast changed the way I approach collecting. I don't know if you remember this, but we before our big podcast that we did in my Studio City place, me, Arthur, and you did a podcast in 2012.
Right.
And during that podcast, you asked the question, you know, what would your advice be to people who, you know, probably can't afford some of the bigger ticket items? You know, how do you build a Houdini collection?
Right.
And I jumped right in saying, well, you know, there's tons of stuff that is affordable and fun to collect. For instance, all this stuff that you've just showed me,
exactly.
The beer steins and the bobbleheads, and you know, there are comic books, and you can create a fun little Houdini collection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in that way. And Arthur said, I have exactly the opposite advice. He said, forget all that stuff. He said, save your money, buy one very nice authentic Houdini item a year.
Mm-hmm.
You can afford that once a year. And after 10 years, you know, you're going to have a very small, but a very valuable and nice Houdini collection. And I was like, oh my God. He's right. This is what I should be doing. And from that day on, that's what I've been doing. You know, I don't buy a lot of this stuff. I just watch and wait. And once a year, I allow myself to spend some money on a really nice
mm-hmm.
collectible.
Nice piece.
Mm-hmm. A nice piece. And so that's what I've been doing. And it's been not quite 10 years, but close to it. And I realized, boy, I've really amassed a collection here that I just love. It's small, but these are really precious items. And so that was a great piece of advice. And this year, I do have what I think is my most favorite thing ever. And that's right behind me, an original Houdini window card from 1926.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you how much I love this thing. I just sit here. You know what I do? You know what I do, Scott?
What?
I take a beer, open up a beer. I slip on my Houdini koozie, which you sent me.
Yeah.
That koozie is great. I've never used a koozie. I now buy beer in bottles just so I can use my Houdini koozie. There's a little Houdini merch.
Yeah.
And I just sit and stare at my window card with my Scott Wells gift of a Houdini koozie. But at the moment, that's just my most favorite thing in the world.
I can see why. That is pretty cool. There was a movie with George Burns and Brooke Shields called Just You and Me, Kid. And there were some other magicians. I think Carl Ballantyne, some others might have been in this movie. But he had these battle axes on the wall or something, and some arcane kinds of things. And she said, why have you got these things on the wall? You know, and he said, well, if I have them and they're just stored in the attic, what would I just say? Yeah, I've got one, or they're up there, or it's back there, whatever. I want to be able to put it out, enjoy it, look at it, and see it every day. I mean, if you have something, put it out. As a result, I've got a lot of crap around my house, you know, but it looks like a museum when people come to see them. I've got just so much stuff that's out and hard to dust and everything, but it's out where I can see it and enjoy it and things. As I look around, it's just appealing to me. And likewise, I think if you have something that does give you joy, put it out. If it doesn't, then pack it up. Get rid of it, you know, give it to someone else who it will give joy to, and like that does for you. And that is a stunning poster back there, by the way, too. I'll put a picture of this on my blog, on the Magic Word Podcast blog, so this way they can kind of see that if they're not watching this on the YouTube.
And you know, there's a story behind that.
Well, of course there is.
I've bored people to tears with talking about my window card. I think people are sick of me and talking about my window card.
Well, you ought to have it summarized now in a shorter time. So,
well, I will give you the very short version because I told a very long version on another podcast. But it's a great story. Essentially, this woman in Warwick, Rhode Island, her name's Heather, very nice. She's remodeling her bathroom, tears out her walls, and in her walls are stacks of Houdini window cards, original Houdini window cards.
No way.
Can you believe this? Yeah. And she's like, huh, Houdini? I wonder if these are worth anything. She takes a picture of them. She puts them on Facebook in a Houdini group, but not a collector group where anyone notices. I see it, and I'm like, holy smokes. We start corresponding. I tell her what they are. These are for real, and offer to help her, you know, if you want. I can hook you up with an auction house. I can hook you up with collectors. I can do whatever. I said, all I ask in return is that you sell me one, you know, the pick of the litter.
Right.
And I was able to also show her, you know, exactly what these things were worth. And eventually what she decided to do was let's go public. You know, it's like, okay, you know, you got yours locked up and let's, you know, put it on your blog and share it with the world, this discovery, and it's on if anyone wants to buy them, which is what we did. And several collectors got some. I got mine, and she got her bathroom remodel paid for.
That's for sure. Were there any more left as of now while we're talking, or have they sold out?
She has one left. Mm-hmm. She sold them very quickly, and I don't know how many she had, but it sounded like she maybe had a dozen. But they were in very bad shape. They had been in the walls, so a lot of them were in pretty bad shape, and there were a lot that were in fragments. I've got a second one in a different style that's in fragments. But I think she had about a dozen that were still intact, and she has, but she has one left that's in.
And they were being sold for about how much?
You know, it was whatever people were, you know, offering and negotiating.
So she negotiated.
She negotiated, you know, individually. But I'll tell you that kind of the starting point for mine was that one of these sold. It was a proof. It was actually a version that didn't have anything on the header except some writing, and that went up for auction a few years back at Potter and Potter and sold for, you know, $2,300 or so. The auction estimate was, you know, 15 to 25. Mm-hmm. Which is still very affordable for any sort of a Houdini printed advertising, and so that sort of set the value of them. So, you know, that's kind of where negotiations start.
And that's a good size. Also, the same thing like with one sheet posters. The smaller they are, they're more easily frameable, if you will, you know, to display in your home. When they get to be 2, 3, 4 sheeters or larger, you know, they're cheaper because you really can't put them up anywhere.
It, you know, that you're so right about that. I mean, it's a perfect size, and look at how good it fits right there.
Sure.
I've got a very small little office, but here's the crazy thing. Well, I love that style window card because it has the kind of Halloween iconography on it, the bats and the witches, which is very spooky considering he would die on Halloween, and that's from October. That card wasn't done for the Halloween season. That was the imagery he used on this final tour, which I've always thought was sort of spooky and cool. Mm-hmm. So I've always loved that card. And when that one sold at Potter and Potter, I was like kicking myself because I didn't even try, because I thought it's going to go for $8,000 or just forget it.
Yeah.
But it sold for 23 or so. And I'm like, that's not out of the
right.
And that would look so good exactly in this space. I had just a reproduction water torture cell in this space, and I was just, it was killing me. I was thinking, I want that image in that space. And then this Warwick, Rhode Island find happens, and suddenly there I have the card in that space. It's like it came true. My dream came true. The card I wanted in the space that I wanted.
That's cool. That's great. Well, what a way to celebrate the Halloween season and the magic week that we're in then now, and also with Halloween coming up then in just a few days from this broadcast, this episode being broadcast then as well. So let me just kind of wrap up over here with this one of asking you, as you know, what your magic word is, if it's evolved since we've talked about last time. What are your thoughts?
I forgot that you did this.
What's the title of my show? The Magic Word Podcast.
I don't remember what I did last time. I suspect last time I said the magic word is Houdini, and I will say that again. The magic word is always, for me, is Houdini.
It is. Well, and that's the final word. Right there you go. What more needs to be said, you know, has put a cap on this. Thank you very much, John. Always a great time to get together and chat with you, and wish you the best with your life and your blog and everything else that's going on. And you really do a lot in this community for us and keeping this going. And congratulations and best of luck.
Thanks, Scott. This is fun.
Good talking to you. And so for the Magic Word Podcast, that was John Cox. This is Scotty out. Wow, what a jam-packed episode this has been. Thank you very much again, John. I appreciate you being my guest here again on the podcast as we had this very special Houdini episode that was all about Houdini. And also, I want to remind everybody that next week I'll be traveling to the Tri-Seas Convention. That is the Carolina Close-Up Convention. Three C's, Tri-C's, get it? So that's the TRICS convention, T-R-I-C-S. So I'll be traveling to Charlotte, North Carolina, and attending the first time the TRICS convention, and I'll be reporting on a couple of days' worth of activities there. So there will not be a podcast released next Thursday at our regularly appointed time, but because I'll be traveling that day, and there'll only be one event scheduled tentatively right now, which will be a lecture late that evening, and then the activities taking place the next day, I'll be posting the next podcast probably sometime late Friday night or early Saturday morning, depending upon your time zone. So just so you know, there will not be one at our regular time next Thursday. And then after that, we will be coming up on episode number 650. And while I was at the Magi Fest a few weeks ago, I spoke with the guest of honor, Mr. Stephen Cohen. And Steve is going to be my guest, not just for one, but for two of those special episodes. That will be another milestone, number 650 in the Magic Word archives. And so I'm going to have him at 650 and 651. So that'll be coming up then later in November, just so you have a sneak peek. If you subscribe to the Pod Letter, you'll know that then as well. Well, let's wrap this up. And let me just say, until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember Houdini. Happy Halloween. This is Scotty out.